This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Folks, you know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's tackling work tasks or conquering chores around the house, treating myself is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but their cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been such an absolute delight, because these are not just your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks. Each month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking while learning? Are you kidding? It's like this was literally made for me. Oh, and each box ships free from Japan straight to your door. I happen to have a box right here, and let me tell you something. I loved the first box they sent so much, I told our ad people, please make sure that Boxu re-ups, because I gotta get another box of these snacks. First of all, check out this incredible guide here full of beautiful photos. It tells you about all the different snacks. You know, my girlfriend's gluten-free, so we can find one in here that makes sure it works for her dietary restrictions. But she's not here right now, so I'm going to make sure I eat one of the gluten-y ones. Ooh, 20th century pear biscuit. This delicate biscuit is a luxurious blend of 20th century Asian pear, rich cheese, and decadent white chocolate. Oh, it contains wheat, so that means I should eat it. All right, let me find it here. 20th century pear biscuit. Okay, here we go. Found it. 20th century pear biscuit. Cute little packaging. Let me give it a try. Oh my gosh. That is so good. Oh, the pear flavor is really strong. It's like a strong aroma. Next to this crunchy biscuit, the textural contrast is really wonderful. I mean, that is so good. And guess what? There are 19 other different snacks in here for me to try. I love this service so much. And you know why? My favorite thing about it is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced these treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, and if you want to try snacks that you literally cannot get anywhere else outside of going to Japan yourself, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. Tell them Adam sent you, and now I got to finish these snacks. Oh man, that's really good. I'm glad she's gluten-free so I could eat this one.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I don't know the truth. I don't know the way. I don't know what to think. I don't know what to say. Yeah, but that's all right. That's okay. I don't know anything.
Hello and welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you so much for joining me on the show again. This week, we're talking about disability. You know, we've all seen these videos that have been coming out for decades. The government or some high-tech company trots out a veteran with a missing arm or leg and says, "Ooh, look at this expensive robot arm we've built. Look at this exoskeleton. Now this poor soul can be a normal like you and me." And then the veteran lifts their robot arm and flexes their robot fingers. The crowd gives a standing ovation, and then we all go back to our normal lives, secure in the fact that this disability has been solved. Now, needless to say, this is a supremely fucked up way to present disability. These demos hide and ignore so much. I mean, you don't even hear a disabled person's voice in them unless it's to say, "Thank you so much, sir." They also avoid questions of cost and access. And worst of all, they present disability as a simple challenge to be simply fixed, to be wished away. But these demos don't present a solution at all. They just present a comforting fiction to those of us who don't yet face these problems. And here's the thing. Disability is not rare. 13% of all Americans are disabled. That's over 42 million people. And the older you get, the more likely it is. Live long enough, and there's a very strong chance that you, yes, you, will become disabled. As you get older, your hearing, vision, mobility, and cognitive capacity are going to decline. And when these things do happen, you're not a heroic vet on a stage with a robot arm. You'll just be a regular person keeping up as best you can with a world that might make little accommodation for you. Some of you listening might be in that boat. I myself have been diagnosed with learning and visual disabilities. And I know that there is no magical solution. I just have to try and keep up. We live in a culture that seeks to hide and solve disability out of existence, and it's bullshit. And in order to change this culture, we first need to understand it. And our guest today is going to help us do that. She's going to help us reframe how we think about disability. She's an absolutely incredible thinker. Her name is Ashley Hsu. She's a professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech who specializes in disability studies and technology ethics. And her new book is called Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. I know you're going to love this interview, but before we get to it, I just want to remind you that if you want to support this show, you can do so on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/Adam Conover. Just $5 a month gets you every episode of the show ad-free, plus a bunch of other great community perks as well. We'd love to see you there. And if you love stand-up comedy, please come see me on tour this year. Coming up, I'm headed to Arlington, Virginia, right outside of D.C., Boston, Philadelphia, New York City, Chicago, Nashville, and Atlanta. Head to adamconover.net for tickets and tour dates. And now, let's get to this interview with Ashley Hsu. Ashley, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you about disability and ableism. It's one of my favorite topics. It's been a little while since we've covered it on the show. You have a new book out called Against Techno-Ableism. I assume this is a word that you've coined. I love new words. What do you mean by this word?
So techno-ableism is this word that I did coin. Thank you. But I don't think I'm describing anything like new if you're a disabled person. Like, I'm describing something that lots of people are noticing, which is the fact that if you're disabled, everything that is marketed to you is supposed to be life-changing, right? Every single technology for disability that we hear about, even if it's not stuff that we're going to particularly want, is marketed as things that are going to fix us, change our world, make things so much more easy and better for us. And it suggests all the time that there's something really wrong with being just disabled and okay. Like, it suggests we always need intervention, even if we're just happily going along in our lives. And it makes disabled people always seem like we're calling out for help. In the way technologies are marketed, thought up, and described. And I think there are lots of people who are writing in this space. There's some really great history written by Jaypreet Verdi at University of Delaware about hearing devices throughout history. I don't end up talking a lot about hearing devices in the book because I think there's actually lots of great writing about hearing devices. So I mentioned these things, but I look specifically at sort of devices aimed at walking. So prosthetic devices and exoskeletons. And then I look at different approaches to thinking about things like neurodiversity and neurodivergent conditions and how we think through these often like reiterates a certain ableism in the approaches that we take.
So let's keep diving into that. What is the problem with some of these walking devices? Do you have a specific example of the mistake that is being made? Because it seems like it's something that would be very natural on its face. Someone can't walk. Oh, let's build a device to help, right?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of these devices are assume a lot about a condition that very few people embody. So a lot of exoskeletons are posited on paraplegic, quadriplegic bodies.
Wait, can you describe what you mean by an exoskeleton and what this sort of device might be?
So sort of like something that you put your body in and it stands you up and helps you walk around. Some of these are highly computerized devices. Some of them are like more passive exoskeletons. There's actually some diversity within this space, but they all see the answer to wheelchairs as exoskeletons, like that there's a problem with using a wheelchair. And a lot of times the way that they are covered in media is to talk about now people don't have to use wheelchairs, when wheelchairs are actually a really great device that take people places. Yeah. So it sort of denigrates a disability technology that already exists. And at the same time, it's aiming, you know, if it's aiming broadly at wheelchair users, many wheelchair users aren't using wheelchairs for issues of paralysis, right? There are plenty of people with POTS or with other issues where they were standing all the time is actually bad for them, right? We're standing, if you're someone with POTS and you stand up quickly, you might fall over and hit your head. And, you know, so you might be using a wheelchair not because your legs don't work and because it's impossible to stand, but standing for long periods of time can be painful for you too. Or you know, that what it's aiming at, if it is a replacement for a wheelchair, which is often how it's described, it's not doing that job, right? It's doing a very different thing. And the question, you know, for a lot of people who are writing in this space is like, who is this really made for? Because particularly if you're looking at, I really love the blog that's called The Bad Cripple. Bill Peace, who has since passed, wrote a lot about exoskeleton devices as a paraplegic man. And talks about how if science and engineering want to invest in research for people like him, that they would be better off talking about bowel and bladder health, to work on issues about pressure sores, right? The things that end up being much larger challenges in a person's life than walking. You know, that there are all these other things that call for more attention that no one wants to talk about or pay attention to because they're not as glamorous, right? You can't get your big engineering team and those photo ops on something related to bladder health quite as easily. That doesn't play in the media quite as well. So we get these stories that sort of glorify big engineering teams taking on these humanitarian goals of helping people walk again. But the question is, like, who are they helping? And the second thing is, like, they often show a real ignorance about the experience of disability. So at one point on the West Coast, there was this great disabled hackathon where Corbett O'Toole was one of the disabled activists who was involved in it. And it was about, like, really centering disabled people's needs. And it was, you know, it was a mostly disabled team. And, like, the thing that they decided that they were going to work on, you know, the thing after the discussion, what was the greatest need in the community? It was a lift to get female wheelchair users onto toilets so that they could toilet themselves, right? That was that was the request. Let's come up with this, you know, open source device that anyone could build that helps people get into a toilet. And so at one point I had an exoskeleton, like, I teach a class on technology and disability. And I just had a picture of an exoskeleton, and we had been reading from different disabled people, and the picture was up on the projector. And one of the students in the class was just looking, like, dumbfounded at this. And they say, how does a person go to the bathroom in an exoskeleton? And the answer, for the exoskeleton that we were looking at, and it was one that had been produced commercially, the answer was the person is going to have to go take off the exoskeleton, sit back in their wheelchair, wheel themselves into the bathroom, put themselves on the toilet, get themselves off the toilet, get back to the exoskeleton and put it on, right? Obviously, people hadn't thought about, you know, walking around's great, but what do you want to do when you're walking around?
Meanwhile,
an advantage, right? You couldn't do a basic human task.
And meanwhile, the actual folks who are wheelchair users are saying, hey, what I really need is the part where I get out of the toilet. That's the actual problem in my day. So what do you mean when you say that these devices are made for, who are they for, right? The implication that you're making is that they're for the people who invented them or who are developing them in some way. And could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, if you're Bill Peace, and he's not the only one to observe this, you have to look at who these devices are being funded by. And a lot of exoskeletons are being funded by the Department of Defense or DARPA. And Bill Peace would tell you that this is really some sort of humanitarian cover for what is building super soldiers. So actually, like, a lot of times the disabled people, like, oh, this is a nice story that sort of covers up what the ultimate goals of a technology are, right? It's a way for the engineers on the team to feel good about a project that maybe we shouldn't be feeling that good about.
It also, I mean, so much of the time, and I talked in the intro about these tech demos I've seen my entire life about, like, look, we've built a prosthetic arm for veterans who have lost an arm, you know, or whatever. And the question that is never asked in those demos is, why is this person missing an arm? You know, like, this person's a veteran, right? they have suffered a an injury, a disabling injury. maybe that's the, maybe we could look at that end of the problem. You know what I mean? Rather than have, you know, DARPA funded, you know, high tech fixes. There's always sort of a question missing there.
Yeah. And so there are a lot fewer arm amputees than there are leg amputees. But there are a ton of projects related to the creation of arms. And part of the reason is, I mean, because most amputees are leg amputees, you can actually get better prosthetic legs. Like the field is more advanced when it comes to prosthetic legs. So they have more people to try them on, right? But when it comes to prosthetic like hand devices, there's also a lot of people who want to like DIY and 3D print. And the thing is, if your hand fails, you drop something. Right. Or it falls off or something like that. But if your prosthetic leg fails, you're breaking a hip. Right. They're right. Like they sort of like what is fun to play around with in the lab doesn't always translate to what's useful to people. Right. I think about a lot of these projects as being like fun for engineers to think about and to think about themselves as being humanitarian in this work. But often it's really divorced from any engagement with disabled people ourselves. And I spend a nice portion of one of my chapters talking about why a lot of hand amputees, arm amputees don't end up wearing hands or arms. I mean, part of that is insurance. You're much more likely to get coverage in the United States for a prosthetic leg. There's also a lot less legs need to do, right? So my leg, I need to stand, I need to sit. I don't care about running. Running's terrible. Right. Like there's the, a couple things that my leg needs to do. Hands do lots more things than legs do. Right. Yeah. So the sort of like finding a good replacement for this thing that does so many other things is actually like a design issue. But then there's also like a lot of people like adapt and use lots of different tools. Right. You have the cutting boards with spikes that you like slam something onto. So then you just cut with your other hand. Right. Lots of people, there are more congenital arm amputees than leg amputees. So a lot of people have their arm amputations, limb difference from birth. And that means that a lot of times they adapt and know how to do a whole bunch of stuff that if you are a new arm amputee, you need to pay attention and watch what they're doing so you can learn. But a lot of disabled people adapt to what they have. That means we also adapt to the tools that we're given. And sometimes you have people who are using like really old timey throwback tools because that was what they got when they were young and that's what they mastered. So there's really a wide realm. And a lot of times disabled people are really like stereotyped, right? Like, if you're an amputee, you're going to need X. And that's not necessarily true. Like we can make lots of different choices. But a lot of the ways these technologies are marketed and understood, like really suggests that there's like a one-to-one matchup between different technologies and different disability types that I don't think really exist. Like the things that we exchange in community, the tips and tricks, often end up like having cross applications in ways that the people who are designing for us without any of our input, like really fail to account for.
Yeah. It seems that the people who are making this technology, and by the way, I'm sure there's people who are doing a better version of what you're talking about out there, but we're talking about the people who are making the mistake, right? And those who are making the mistake are, it almost seems as though they're fantasizing about what disabled people need. They're looking at a disabled person saying, this person can't walk. This person is missing an arm. This person can't see. That I would feel bad if that was me. What they need is some device that turns them back into me. They need a prosthetic that like exactly duplicates the hand. They're making a very sort of basic assumption, which is maybe very natural if you have that level of ignorance, but it's like a really strong assumption about what is actually needed, which is, as you say, to fix the person, right? Can we talk more about that assumption? Like, where does that come from?
Oh, I mean, ableism is pretty deeply embedded in everything. It's like actually
this is
hard
the root
to talk
of ableism.
And you know, so when I talk about ableism in my classes, I like to say that ableism is the sauce we're all marinated in. Like disabled people also like experience lateral ableism, internalized ableism. Like it's not like we're born free from the sort of prejudice that like exists all around us about other types of disability, and a lot of these things are reiterated in school environments, a lot of these things are reiterated in medical environments, but even regular social interaction, you know, we've been taught to devalue disabled testimony, disabled voices. And so many of our stories about disability, when they have any disabled people at all, right? And keep in mind, like, disabled people constitute like 15 to 20% of the population, right? At any yeah. given time. And the dearth of stories about disabled people is alarming. Like, just to be regular, like, side characters or main characters and who happen to be disabled is so rare. And even when we have disabled characters who are written, it's usually for like a very special episode of something, or it is, you know, it often falls into one of a number of tropes. I have a chapter on different tropes about disability in this book, because even when we think we're doing what's best for disabled people, often that's really been informed by media representation that's really very skewed about what disabled people need and sort of disabled people's relationships with non-disabled people, right? As sort of like always calling out for need, but everyone has needs, right? Everyone, yeah. You know, experiences a lot of the things disabled people too, but disabled people are really like exceptionalized, stigmatized, and, you know, often are encouraged to pass as well as possible, right? To downplay any disability. And so, like, there are so many tropes that like really revolve around overcoming disability, where overcoming disability means being less disabled, right? There's it's wound up with sort of anti-immigration sentiment, the way people are discussed. It's bound up with white supremacy. So sort of like the sort of way in which we value different people and groups of people often is like legitimated based on sort of anti-disability tropes. So we have a whole history of like IQ testing that,
yeah.
you know, white European men do better on IQ testing. You know, surprise, they wrote the tests. There's a whole history of that being like weaponized and used to like justify, well, we want immigrants from these places, but not these. Right. Yeah. And that is based on like sort of ideas about intelligence that aren't actually very real to the world. There's a long history of like using BMI in this way too. Mm-hmm. And one I feel like is very much ongoing for both of these things.
When you say that 15% of people are disabled, it raises the question for me of who identifies themselves as disabled. You know, how are we even making that categorization? I mean, I spoke a number of years ago on an older version of this podcast with Judith Heumann before she passed away. And it was a really revelatory conversation for me. Obviously, legendary disability rights activist, for those who don't know, please go back and listen to that episode if you haven't heard it. But, you know, she made me confront the fact that I don't think of myself as disabled, yet I have a vision impairment. That's very serious. That's part of why I don't drive. I have ADD. I have a learning disability. Maybe those things combined are why I don't really feel comfortable driving, along with the fact that I hate cars and car culture. But, you know, I'm not disabled in my Twitter bio. Right. And she also pointed out this is the, you know, one of the identities that almost everybody will join as you age, right? As you age, you are likely to become disabled. And you know, I have a complicated relationship with that because I'm like, okay, well, I'm not medicated anymore for the ADD, but I get along fine. You know, I have my coping mechanisms. I have, you know, lenses obviously for my eyes, et cetera. And so it may, you know, when I start thinking about that, it makes me confront like, okay, what is my relationship with disability? And then what is everybody else's? And is that 15% potentially a lot larger? And is the reason it isn't is because of ableism overall. So that's what I'm coming to it with. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of what I just said.
I mean, I do feel sometimes like I'm always recruiting disabled people because you go over that and I'm like, you're disabled, you know, come sit with us. But there's like so many ways in which, you know, I don't necessarily need everyone to pipe up and say I'm disabled. But I do think that there's something really powerful in thinking about yourself as part of a disability community, right? I think mm-hmm. about all the things, like I have chemo brain, it quacks a lot like ADHD. I talk about that in the book too, where I am listening in anytime any of my friends with ADHD is speaking about their disability, I am leaning in to get whatever tips and tricks they are using to try out in my own life, right? Like I know that these are the people, like this is the neurotype I need to pay attention to. You know, and I think there's a difference, you know, also in talking about sort of impairment and disability. I think when we adjust, we don't always experience our disabilities as impairments, right? I don't think that's true in all cases, but I think about this a lot with chemo brain. Like I have brain damage from chemotherapy. Like that's not something I'm getting out of. That's like the state of things. I had chemotherapy 10 years ago, right? It's not getting better. You know, they always tell you after you finish chemo, oh, let's just wait a year and see if you are still experiencing this symptom. And I was and am and will continue to. But, and you know, my first few years, it was awful, right? Because I hadn't figured out how to manage this thing. So my friend Liz Spingola, who was in disability community with me on campus, and we did like, you know, different disability advocacy in our community. You know, every time she would talk and say things that she was doing, I was like, oh yeah. And so all of a sudden I'm programming the time my kids need to get picked up from school into my phone, right? I'm doing what Liz does, right? She programs all these things into her phone by day of the week so that she shows up places on time and doesn't leave her kids at school. Actually, she didn't have kids, I could imagine like how I could use what she was talking about. And I don't experience my chemo brain as impairment in the way that I did, right? I have different fixes, right? And some of them are technological, like I'm using my phone. It's not a specific app for disability, but it is using it for a disability purpose. And I find like the things that we exchange in community are often much more powerful. You know, there's also, you know, people with ADHD, I mean, they have options in terms of medication, but there's also, what is it? It's called body doubling, where you schedule time for a friend to come over so that you can complete a chore. Your friend doesn't help you with that chore, but having someone there and you saying, hey, I'm going to complete this chore, means that you're going to do the chore. You know, sometimes we do writing groups because I'm, you know, in an academic environment and we all need to do writing and it's impossible to sit by yourself and write. If you're sitting with your friends, you're getting a lot more writing done because you said you would. And like the peer pressure of that produces. Yeah.
I write so much better when I'm writing with another person. That's why, you know, if I'm working in a writer's room or with another writer in my comedy writing, it goes much better because we are, you know, it helps me focus. And when I get distracted, the other person can pick up the slack a little bit. Whereas solo writing, I experience, you know, as kind of hell. I mean, and so do people who don't have ADD. I think writing is one of the worst tasks anyone can ever do. But it is, it's funny because I have not thought about that as an ADD coping strategy. And yet now I'm realizing that it is. And so I just find it interesting, though. I'm sure I have plenty of ableism, right? That I'm a very functional person in my life. I treasure all the things that I can do. I'm very proud of them. And I know that I have a bit of a fear of, you know, being, you know, like losing ability. Right. And I also sort of recognize, oh, that might cause me to sort of push down these other things as me conceiving of them as disability, which is, you know, I'm sort of, oh no, that's not me. No. I'm a regular, you know what I mean? I can do whatever. And that's, I think that's part of the entire psychological problem that you're talking about, that leads people to make this error, is conceiving of themselves as separate from truly disabled people. Is that making sense?
Yeah. And I think a lot of disabilities are really zigzaggy, variable. Yeah. And a lot of our representations of disability are really static. Right. So we don't have a lot of representations where some days you get up and you're fully functional and the next day you have to stay in bed, or, you know, you have a pain flare, or your Crohn's disease or autoimmune condition is all of a sudden upon you and you might need accommodations today when you didn't yesterday. Like, we don't actually have very many representations where a person's sort of like experience of their disability varies over time. We have the sort of dramatic, they become disabled, right? Or are cured and it's like blinking in and out. But the sort of long-term variable disability, which is a lot of disabilities. Like, even if you have something like, I'm an amputee. Some days everything's going well and my leg fits well and I'm walking around like the normals. And all those, you know, two-legged assholes out there, I'm just like them. And then, like, the next day, I ate too much salt because I flew too close to the sun. And all of a sudden, I can't fit my prosthesis on, or it's tight, or it's uncomfortable. Or because I had such fun yesterday, like, I have some metal in my hip, right? And all of a sudden, my hip aches. It's the same disability. Right. And I say, oh, I'm an amputee. Sometimes I get hip pain. But I don't always have hip pain. Right. There's this sort of, like, even if I'm experiencing something that people think about as really static. Right. I have a particular like level of amputation. And that's not really going to change unless I get a pressure sore and I have to get they call it a revision when you need a second amputation above your original amputation site, which is just such, like, whenever I go to do revisions on a document now, like, I'm haunted by this particular idea. Like, you're just going to cut further up and we can get it right this time. Sometimes amputees also become more amputee, like, in some way, like an additional badge on there. But, like, in general, like, this is static and it's unchanging, but it also, like, that doesn't mean my status around it, like, is always the same. So I think, like, especially for when we're talking about things like ADHD, most people experience that in a ziggy-zaggy kind of way.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's really hard. I know, like, it's really hard for people to ask for accommodations because you say, well, I can do this sometimes. Right. And that's a little internalized ableism. You're like, well, I can do it sometimes, so I don't need that help. Right.
Therefore, the one time I can do it, it's my own fault. Right.
Yeah. And then you can, you know, push that back on yourself. And I feel like we need more representations where disability is, like, zigzagging more. And we also do this thing where we, if you've done it once, you should be able to do it again. That's not true all the time. Right. Different, like, levels of fatigue, different situations in your life, you might not be able to do the same thing that you did before in the same way you used to. And we have such a, like, a lot of people really want to police disability, right? I see this around disabled parking on a regular basis. I've had to explain, at one point someone was complaining to me that everyone took all the disabled spots during a rainstorm and they were just being lazy and didn't want to get rained on. And I'd just like to suggest, as someone who experiences hip pain related to weather, that sometimes people are walking further because they can walk further on a given day. But a lot of times with weather-related pressure changes, a whole bunch of people who have arthritis, who have different metal implants in their body, are they're experiencing the weather different. They're experiencing it in an embodied way, and they're going to need disability parking. Like, they probably don't need it all the time, right? If they're not regularly parking there. And so disability parking gets really crowded on rainy days. But I don't doubt that all those people are disabled, right? There's people who want to also rank which disabilities matter more than others. We see a lot of lateral ableism even within disability community where, some disabilities are, like, more stigmatized or even seen as less valid.
Do you have a general example of that without, calling anybody out?
Yeah. So lateral ableism is something, when I see, and this is the sort of the classic version of this, is someone who's physically disabled saying, well, but it doesn't affect my mind. With the suggestion that, in fact, they are ranked higher somehow than people who have disabilities that affect their cognition in some way. And it's kind of shitty to do to other people because, I don't think any of these hierarchies make sense, like in an enduring kind of way, right? We'll have different needs. It's okay that we have different needs, right? That doesn't mean that your disability counts more than mine does, right? If I'm an arm amputee, disability parking is probably not going to help me. Like it's not going to, like, even the playing field, like, in terms of, like, my energy in a given day, right? So arm amputees generally don't have disability placards, and that makes sense. But for people who have trouble walking long distances or who get out of breath really easily, so people with COPD and that kind of thing, like, having disability parking can mean the difference between being there or not. And that is, They just have different needs. It's not that one counts more than the other.
Well, that brings a question to mind for me that really cuts to the core of the definition of disability that I'd love you to answer. But before we get to it, we have to take a quick break. So we'll be right back with more Ashley Hsu. I think that was a pretty good tease for the second half of the show. I hope you agree. Folks, today's sponsor is one I cannot recommend highly enough, Delete Me. As a Factually listener, you know how much I value online privacy. Well, Delete Me has been an indispensable tool for me for many years. I've been using them long before they even started advertising on this show. This day and age, it is shockingly simple for data brokers to peddle your personal information without your consent. These data brokers may be selling your name, phone number, and home address, and you might never even know it's happening. Trying to locate and remove all this data yourself can feel like an impossible task, but that is where Delete Me shines. Their team of experts tirelessly scour the web to track down and wipe out your personal data. In just 7 days, you will receive a detailed report of their findings. And believe it or not, a whopping 41% of Americans are vulnerable to online harassment, from doxing to scams and even identity theft. In some cases, having your info online can turn cyber stalking into good old-fashioned in-person stalking. Protect yourself from these threats with Delete Me. So if you're like me and you value your personal privacy, you want to make sure that your identifying personal details are not floating around the internet where anybody can buy them, well, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/Adam and use promo code Adam at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Adam, code Adam. I wholeheartedly recommend this service. Check out Delete Me. Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Our lives are super demanding these days. I know that I constantly catch myself wishing for extra hours in the day. But here's the thing. The problem isn't as simple as lack of time. It's that we often have trouble prioritizing what's actually important to us, whether that's seeing friends, talking to family, or even kicking back with a good book. This is one of the ways that therapy can be so valuable. Working with a professional can help you figure out your priorities and make time for the stuff that really matters. And therapy isn't just for big trauma. We can all use a little help, whether it's learning to deal with stress, setting boundaries, or just getting stuff off your chest. So if you're thinking about giving therapy a shot, you might check out BetterHelp. They say it's all online, super flexible, and fits right into your busy life. You just answer a few questions, and they say that they will hook you up with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time, no extra charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/factually today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/factually. We're back with Ashley Hsu. So we were talking about, you know, ableism generally, how different disabilities affect people differently. But something that I've been rolling around in my mind for a while is, isn't the definition of disability somehow bound up in the world that we live in, right? Because if you are able to do something versus not able to do something, that can be because of the built environment around you or the accommodations that are given to you. Someone who is, you know, has the difficulty reaching very high. Well, if there are no things on high shelves, they are not necessarily impaired vis-a-vis that, you know, particular task, right? Or, you know, I have a friend who's a dear friend who's a wheelchair user, and, you know, the right curb cuts make all the difference, right, in terms of his ability to get around. And when I think about my own disabilities, why I don't often think of them as such, it's because, well, in most cases, you know, I have corrective lenses and I have other ways I can get around, et cetera. Is that not a big piece of the puzzle?
Yeah. So I think you're sort of alluding to the social model of disability, right? That we're more disabled by sort of the built environment and sort of like people's like preconceived notions, like in our social world. So social barriers, mm-hmm. but infrastructural barriers that sort of impact like who is experiencing the world differently or in an alternative fashion than the other people around them. And I think there's, you know, I talk a little bit about the social model, and I love the social model. I don't think there's like one overriding model for disability that we're all going to agree on and that will be satisfying for every type of disability. But I like the social model because it gives us things to work on, right? And it suggests that it's not all up to the individual, that there are lots of ways in which you can negotiate space and change different attitudinal barriers so that you can make progress towards disability inclusion. You know, I think even if everything were set up in the most inclusive way possible, you will still have people who experience long-term pain, right? You will still have, you know, people who cannot work a sort of like regular work day. You will still, like, even if we have like very modified sort of work days, which we should, a very flexible time, which we ought to, you're still going to have people who are outliers in some sense. So I like the social model because sort of like we get ideas about universal design. Like we like revise the world in a particular way. More bodies can exist comfortably. If we make flexible schedules, if we use universal design for learning to include more people in classrooms and make it easy to turn in assignments and do a lot less like bullshit in terms of like the barriers towards entrance. Like, oh, you have to put things in this font, in this, you know, like there's so many like small things that people require in education that just seem completely worthless to me. You know, if we set all of these things and we give the notes ahead of time and like even if we did all of those things, I think you will still have people who experience particularly painful conditions and like energy related disabilities that, you know, they'll be better included, but it's not gonna, you know, take everything away. So I do see that there are lots of shortcomings to the social model, but I think it's really useful for political action. And to sort of think about technology too, because as a disabled person encountering the world, you know, yes, I'm wearing some of the technologies that I'd like to take advantage of. Some of them work better than others. And I think we also forget that a lot of disability technologies require a lot of maintenance and care and a lot of work on the part of the disabled person to use them. But I also want to have a world in where you know, I should be able to exist in several formats, right? If I want to use a wheelchair on a given day because of different issues I'm having, I should be able to switch, right? And not have a problem. My friend Mallory K. Nelson talks about this idea as transmobility. And it's a really lovely idea. And she's one of my fellow amputees. She's multiply disabled as well, just like you are too. I'll hit on that in a moment. But she talks about how we actually have more choices in terms of how we move about in the world than non-disabled people do. So if you're a leg amputee like she and I are, you might use forearm crutches. You could use a wheelchair. You could use a prosthetic leg. You could use a combination of these devices, and you can appear in different formats at different times. And it might not say anything like about you or what you believe about yourself that you are appearing in that embodiment like on a particular day. So she switches a lot between her wheelchair and crutches. And her forearm crutches, she can go so fast on them. She can go downstairs on those. Like, I love watching her on those bad boys. She's an amazing crutch user. I met her when I was a fairly like new amputee, and she had been one for like 2 decades at that point. And I was just so impressed with her skills. But she moves really fluidly, and like a lot of her choice is about what she plans to do that day. Is she going to go a really long distance? Well, then she's using her wheelchair, and then she has like a special thing that she tucks her crutches into her wheelchair. That had to be hacked by someone. Like, that was not a standard wheelchair thing to have your crutches click right into your wheelchair. But at some point, she got someone to put on what I think is a holder for brooms, which is the perfect size for her crutch that she got to like drill into her wheelchair and screw onto the side. And it works great as a hack. That's not something they offer because they only expect one form of mobility. Insurance will pay for one thing. Right. And this is like a really real impediment. Like, I have to decide what my embodiment is going to be for the rest of, until I can afford a new device. And some of these, like we're talking wheelchair, that's custom. Right. You want something if you're using it all the time. You know, she went back and forth with her insurance for a long time because they were willing to pay for a prosthetic leg. And she is a hemipelvectomy, meaning half of her pelvis. Like, she's the highest level. I love that we call it highest level because it sounds like she's a wizard, right? She's reached the highest level of leg amputee. But it means like she would need a hip joint, a knee joint, an ankle. Right. Those are the expensive pieces on a prosthetic limb. Her insurance would have paid for over $100,000 of leg equipment, but they would not pay. She didn't want the leg because, of course, it's very high up and there's not a lot to hang that prosthetic limb on once you have that high of an amputation. Right. So there's like a cost to wear and it's very heavy, hard to move in. She wanted to get forearm crutches with like shock absorption that would really help her preserve her rotator cuffs, her wrists and all of this. So $1,000 for a pair of forearm crutches. And she was like, hey, insurance, could you pay for these forearm crutches? I do not want the prosthetic leg. I would like this other thing that has more value to me, even though it's like 1% of the cost. And insurance said,
really?
Insurance says no. Because they won't pay for more expensive forearm crutches. They will pay for your basic level forearm crutch, which is like $80.
And why would they rather pay $100,000 for a high-tech solution than $1,000 for a forearm crutch? Like, obviously, there's some bureaucratic problem. If you ask anybody at the company, they would get it. But there's some policy choice being made further upstream. And so what is this? You know, what is the source of this obsession with this sort of high-tech fix?
Well, I mean, I think about this as, you know, if you're an amputee, a leg amputee, people really want to see you walking and standing, because almost mm-hmm. every amputee that they've seen is, and scare quotes here, overcoming their disability with technology. Like, we're being sold a story about technology as well as a story about disability, right? We're being told, you know, if there isn't yet a fix for you, you should be investing, probably asking a venture capitalist to invest in technology that will fix you one day. So there's like a strong preference, like even when you go out socially as an amputee, for you to wear your leg among other people you run into, right? I have a friend who's been like regularly quizzed in a grocery store because he wasn't wearing a prosthetic leg. Right. You know, if he appears without it, he was scrutinized in his small town. Like, why don't you have your leg on? You know, and essentially implying that he wasn't trying hard enough if he didn't give the technology time.
Or somehow inconveniencing the other people by appearing without the prosthetic leg, which made them more comfortable. Well,
and
perhaps
he wasn't asking for any sort of, he's just picking out groceries. Like there's it. And, you know, some amputees get told that they're indecent for not wearing their legs in public.
Right? How dare you be disabled in front of us?
How dare you be visibly disabled and not trying to look otherwise, right? Not trying to pass. Yeah. And sometimes pass is a functional pass, not a like visible pass. But there is like a huge emphasis on walking and in ways that are really toxic. So I think about this in terms of sort of amputee communities. At one point, I was trying to join the amputee support group in the adjacent community to mine, because my community didn't have one then. And I had left a message with the woman who ran the group, and she called me up. And I was, you know, I was not even a year out of my amputation. And I have a really rare type of amputation that's probably too hard to explain at the moment. But like, I had to wait for my bones to fuse before I could bear full weight, right? So I had to use crutches and my prosthetic leg for like 11 months after my surgery. Wow. I was using crutches still. And then I dropped down to one crutch and then eventually to a cane because I was on chemotherapy. Like, my body was not healing at all. It was bad. But she was like quizzing me, and I just like dropped down to using the cane. And she gave me like, she asked me all of these questions about my gait, about how well I walked. Like, her first question is, are you using a prosthesis? How well are you walking? Have you dropped, like, you're not using anything else? And of course, I was still using my cane. And I remember, like, her saying at the end of the conversation that there were two old guys in the group who wouldn't even try wearing legs. And maybe it would be a kick in the pants to them to have me show up to this group. I did not show up. I'm not here to shame people into wearing their legs. like the whole idea that the reason that
and this was in the amputee support group that you were getting this.
Oh, no, it was the amputee support group. And I'm encountering this like gatekeeper to the amputee support group who wants to make sure like that I'm going to be like a good influence. And the thing is, I met these guys a couple years later because they were like friends from the same region. I put it together. They were part of this support group. And the thing is,
you're like, these were the guys.
I met the guys, and they were great. I met them, their wives. They do a lot of road trips and camping together. Like, they are disabled friends who were chuckleheads. We had a great time.
They're living their best lives with no prostheses.
And they're not using prostheses at all. But But that wasn't like limiting their lives in any way. They were going on more adventures than I was when I met them at the amputee coalition meeting that I ran into them at and like connected the dots that these were the people that this woman was going to bring me into shame. And it just struck me as so absurd that we would do that level of like insisting how other people's bodies should be. And then like trying to set up other disabled people against each other in ways that are really toxic and ugly.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. I know we're in the ad break, but we're doing something a little bit different today. Today, I'm going to tell you about an amazing group of people who did not pay us anything to be a part of the show. We just think they do amazing work, and we wanted you to know about them. You might remember back in 2018, those heart-wrenching stories of families torn apart by Border Patrol, refugee children being pulled away from their parents who were in turn deported to their home countries. It was devastating then, and it's just as devastating now, with hundreds of families still not reunited after all these years. You know, we discuss so many problems on Factually, but I firmly believe that there is always something that can be done about those problems. And recently, I came across an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they have successfully brought together over 100 families torn apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. But reuniting those families is just the beginning. Al Otro Lado continues to support each family with legal aid, housing, and counseling to help heal and get back on their feet. I mean, can you imagine the agony of having your child ripped from your arms, unsure of when you'll see them again? We cannot allow such family separations to continue. So if you're like me and believe that all families belong together, then join me in supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website at alotrolado.org/volunteer. Thank you so much.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So when it comes to technology, because this, again, is the subject of your book, and thank you so much for talking about every dimension of disability. But how do we tell the difference between, you know, when we're looking at a new technology, a good technology and a bad technology? Because obviously, corrective lenses, for instance, are, I think, pretty unequivocally good, right, for sight impairment, very simple technology. But there's others, you know, an exoskeleton that doesn't let you pee, maybe bad. So what is the distinction for you?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with the desires of disabled people in community with each other. You know, I want multiple ways to be in the world. Like, I think one of the problems with like how we set up technology and disability is that we're getting this story about disability wrong all the time because we have all these tropes and we like want to force things to fit particular molds. And this is like longstanding. I love this one quote from Harriet McBride Johnson in her book, Accidents of Nature, which is about disabled kids at disabled summer camp. And two of the girls are talking to each other. And one says, like, she wishes there was just one story in the Bible where the crip didn't get cured so that she could just be and be disabled and not have people try to intervene. Right. So I think we've wedded a lot of these stories where disabled people like the call out for intervention or need to be overcoming or like there's a couple of these tropes that have like a long history here. And I think we wed that with like real optimistic ideas about what technology can do for us. And this is where I think disability being so exceptionalized and abnormalized is really a problem because, you know, as we may have experienced in trying to set up this particular audio situation. It took us 25 minutes, everybody.
For those who were not, well, nobody heard this because it happened before the podcast. It took us a good half hour to get audio set up for this podcast which were recording remotely, very common problem, but it was a little tricky today.
It was. And, you know, it's complicated by the fact that I have like Bluetooth hearing aids on. Like, I don't reject technology, right? But I think we tend to like idealize technology for disability, right? Because we've exceptionalized and abnormalized disability. Technology for disability always has to be wonderful. We can never just have incremental changes, right? Where the material, like I really like material, like the material history of prosthetic devices is really interesting, right? But sometimes better materials are just better materials. It's not life changing for me, right? It's just better. And a lot of times we cover over sort of issues of like maintenance and wear. And there are lots of people like Josh Earle, who's talking about cyborg maintenance as a regular theme. Like disabled people are regularly having to think about how to repair these technologies, how to negotiate, like when things are out of warranty, how to deal with systems that don't want to give us stuff. Like, I feel like when we're describing technology for disability, we think it's going to be a quick and easy fix because that's what people want. But if you've ever experienced technology as a human being, it's never as clean and as perfect as the manufacturer promised it would be. And I think we lose out on how normal technology is for disabled people too, and normal in the way that it plays out in the same patterns as it does in everyone else's life, where you get a new operating system on your computer and it is the worst day of your life because everything's in the wrong place. And it's intensified. Oh, it's intensified. If you're someone who uses, you know, screen reading software and you get an update, all of a sudden, like basic technologies that you used in your life are gone. Right. And we forget that all of these things require constant monitoring, constant wear, you know, that these are things we wear close to our bodies or close at hand, you know, when we talk about different apps and things like that. And I think when we're always praising technology for disability, we tend not to see the technologies for what they are.
Mm. And what are they? Is that too general of a question? Like, we tend to not see them for what they are. That made me want to go...
No,
what the hell are they, though?
So I'm from philosophy of technology. So you asked me, what are they when it comes to technology? And we could be here for like, you know, several centuries. But I think there's a fundamental, like, technology is no one thing, right? Technologies ideally are tools that help us get things done. Sometimes they can change our lives, sure. But most of the time, they're just changing how we do things, not what we do, right? And I feel like a lot of our stories about disability technology like suggests that if we just got the technology right, that disability wouldn't be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Or it ceased to exist.
And there are so many movements, you know, when I think about all of the science fiction that writes disabled people out of the future, right? That's not a realistic vision. Like the future is going to be more disabled, not less. Climate change is coming. More people are going to have, you know, when we talk about pollution and rates of asthma and different types of cancers, you know, even if we got off planet, like, space is disabling. It is not our environmental niche. It will hurt our bodies. It'll probably hurt our minds too. Right. Yeah. Like there's all of these like elements towards no matter what future we envision, we're going to experience more disability, not less. So our continually, the way in which we continually write out disability in all media, but also in how we regard the future, like really keeps us from confronting like basic things we need to about how technologies work, right? And that they're not always constant, that we need maintenance, that it takes a certain level of care and investment in infrastructure. I think about how all of these one-off devices where, oh, this is going to change everything for you, like only operates with certain like environmental considerations, right? And as soon as those break, then things aren't going to go as well. I think about this a lot with like self-driving cars, right? Which of course we want because we haven't invested in high-speed rail, right? Why do we need self-driving cars? We failed at the other transport for lots of different social reasons. But it's really hard to program these things because our roads are so irregular, right? Yeah. Our infrastructure itself makes all of these things that we think about as sort of quicker technological projects are so much more complicated by the fact that we're not making crucial investments in basic infrastructure.
Yeah. Well, and oh God, we can't start talking about self-driving cars because then I will never shut up.
I'm so excited for you.
it's my absolute favorite topic. but what this reminds me of is a theme that we've come back on this show to again and again, which is that our sort of material technology in certain places has become very advanced. You know, the iPhone is one of the most advanced pieces of technology in countless ways. And yet our social technology, the technology of our society, how our democracy works, how we include people's voices in conversations, how we make decisions as groups, right? There's a way to define technology in my sort of naive view that includes like those processes as well. And that has not advanced, you know, the means by which we make decisions about how to build our society, about what material technologies to pursue, that would mean, you know, an advance there would mean rooting out ableism and having a more inclusive way to talk to people. I don't know. Does that metaphor make sense to you at all?
Yeah. I think there's something to be said about paying attention to disability politics.
Mm.
Right. I think about the ways in which disabled groups, because we're all very different, have worked towards things like across difference, right, to get important pieces of legislation passed. And of course, if you had Judy Heumann here, you might have run into some of these concepts before. But the different types of like coalition building that exists in disability circles is really interesting, because often it involves like confronting our own ableism about each other, right? Because this is the soup we're all stewing in. We have all of these biases, but learning to like appreciate the contributions of other people and see sort of like where we can work together, I think that's actually really important. I think having a disability politics is much more important to me than like having individual disabled people, right? We need to have an ethos of making space for each other in terms of like setting up accessible experiences in every part of things. And it's not that all disabled people like agree all the time, but there is a sense in which I'm going to provide the mechanism like to hear other people out. And sometimes that takes time. Like, and I think about this, there's lots of theorizing about crip time, right? About how sometimes it takes disabled people longer or shorter times in some cases to do particular tasks. Sometimes we don't show up on time because we're dealing with, pain flares or something like that, and how we can't work always at the same pace. And it's just much like this concept gives us some flexibility for thinking about how this is a much broader human experience, like that all like lots of other different types of disability share. And I really like that sort of community theorizing that happens. And I think cross community action is so important on a lot of these things. But actually learning to listen to other people is a big part of that.
Yeah. And I'm really grateful to you for the reminder that that's a community that I can participate in more fully myself, given my own, as you say, multiple disabilities. You said you would return to that.
Yes.
I'm curious what
Let
you meant
me tell
by
you.
That.
Okay. So this is a thing I think about quite often because I'm at a research university, but most recruiting for research projects is about people having one disability and not others. Right. If you have criteria for people that you would like to have as human subjects for different types of technology or scientific research, usually you want people who are in the absence of other disabilities, which means because most of us are multiply disabled, you and I both, most disabled people are multiply disabled people. So most scientific research about disability actually doesn't represent most disabled people. There's this interesting like sort of inversion that sort of happens there, right? Where most people don't have just one, but when we're testing devices, we want people to have just one. I've started to think about like how to address this problem in scientific research, especially about technology, but kind of in all areas, because this is actually very bad, because when people announce their exoskeleton, they're like, well, this is for paraplegic people of this particular type of spinal cord injury. And you're like, well, that is a much smaller population than it was initially advertised as.
I know we're so down on exoskeletons, but every time you say the word, I picture an exoskeleton and I'm like, that's pretty fucking sick. Like they do look cool.
I mean,
there is that. And I do think that that must be part of the desire to build them, is like, you see The Edge of Tomorrow or some movie where someone's an exoskeleton. You're like, yeah, that's fucking sick. I mean, for me,
ever since that one student pointed out the issue with the bathroom, I look at exoskeletons and I go, you won't be able to pull your pants down and sit on the toilet. Like, it's much more, I guess, because, I mean, one of the things I also have is Crohn's disease. So going to the bathroom is an important part of my life, and it needs to be quick. Oh, my God.
Of course it is. And that's the problem with, you know, science fiction leaving disability, or even, frankly, bathrooms. Most science fiction doesn't have any bathrooms at all.
Yeah.
And no one's even thinking about, I mean, no one thinks about the fact that on Star Trek, they're all wearing jumpsuits. They're all having to unzip and pull, take all their clothes off to go to the bathroom.
It's not nobody convenient thinks technology. About this. It's not convenient technology for this, for sure. No, I don't know if you remember the show 24 that used to run. I like used to wait for someone to use the bathroom. Like, if they're going to show me a 24-hour period and no one uses the bathroom, like, I feel like something's gone wrong for all of those people.
I'm curious what a science fiction, you know, future that does, you know, make space for disabled people. Like, what does that look like? Or do you have any, you know, favorite thinkers who are envisioning that? Yeah.
So my colleague Damian Williams really got me excited about the show The Expanse, which really which has like ideas about like how space will like affect human bodies in the long term. So you actually see like once like Martians come back to Earth, like they can't stand up or get oriented, and it's like
because they're born under lower gravity and
yeah. So I think there's some really like exciting science fiction, like when they do like admit that space will disable our bodies. I think The Expanse is really cool. You know, there's some other like things about like genetic engineering. Lois Bujold has this one book where like basically people who are supposed to go work off site, being the site being Earth. So people who need to go work in space, actually like breeding them to have four arms instead of two arms, two legs, because it's much more convenient for pushing and moving around and doing the sort of tinkering tasks that they need to do. But then those they're breeding them to be disabled, but extra functional in a particular context. It's an interesting idea too.
Yeah, that's I know that book and I've never read it, but it's such an interesting concept that yes, if you were born and were working in free fall, you went up there with a body that, you know, had evolved for Earth's gravitation, you would be disabled vis-a-vis free fall, and that, you know, you would actually want a different body in that case. Well, coming back to and bringing us in for a landing here, coming back to technology itself, for the person who is, you know, working in the technological field, right? I sort of imagine the very capable high school student who's doing like the project, you know, they're doing their, oh, I'm going to invent something project. They're like, oh, I want to help a disabled person by inventing some sort of thing to help people see, or some sort of prosthetic limb. I feel like I saw this so much when I was a kid. This is the sort of Eagle Scout type project to help disabled people. What is, we talked about the mistakes that are being made by that person in that case. How would you suggest that they correct that error? What is the step to take to move us in a direction of, you know, thinking about technology in a way that is better?
So Alice Wong talks about disabled people as oracles of the future. And I think it's really important to listen to disabled people on future topics, but also on all sorts of technological topics. So I think like a first step, if you want to help disabled people, is essentially listening to disabled people. And sometimes that can mean picking up some poetry and memoir, right? That doesn't necessarily look like you think it'll look. And I don't think you should like go out and find your first disabled person on like in the grocery store and start asking them questions. Don't do that. Right.
I heard on this podcast that I should ask you questions. What do you need? How do I help you?
I think there are much more organic, less intrusive ways. I mean, a lot of disabled people are just expected to narrate their body for other people. And that's also kind of a terrible thing to have to do on a regular basis. You know, when people ask, what happened? What's wrong with you? Those are questions that disabled people who are visibly disabled get asked on a regular basis. And it's, you know, when I experience that, You know, and I say, well, I'm an amputee from cancer. Like, their follow-up question is usually something like, but you're okay now, right? And I've had two recurrences of my cancer and two lung surgeries related to those recurrences. So I don't feel super confident about saying like, oh yeah, everything's peachy keen now. Like, I am someone whose body is surveilled medically, and I want it to be, right? I think there are, ways of asking these things without being intrusive or without like requiring someone to cheer you up about their disability, which is often the ask. I think disabled people's writing. I think the things that we make. I'm really a fan of the sort of artistic work of Sins Invalid, and so many of the poets and writers that come out of that group that are very proponents of disability justice. I think those are really important artistic movements for disabled people to pay attention to, but also to learn from and having a community identity. I'd love to see more disabled characters written by disabled people, played by disabled people all over. So I've been lucky. I've been having students come to my office all week to discuss. Like, I have a long list of books written by disabled people, and you can read any one of them or see like a list of documentaries or read these books of poetry. Like, it's just a long list, and they can come, pick out one and come talk to me about it. And one of the books that they've been reading is this, it's called One for All by Lily Lanoff. And it's the author has POTS, the main character has POTS, and it's a great book. It's not like totally centered on disability. There's a lovely story about her finding her dad's murderer. I don't know why I would call it a lovely story, but it's a good story.
It's a sweet tale of finding a murderer.
Of avenging your father.
Finding the man who murdered your dad. Oh, it's heartwarming. No, this book sounds great.
But it's a good book, right? It's a young adult novel, but it's like really good disability representation in a way that, I can think of a couple of other novels that this is true for, but it's just really good to see. Yeah.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on to talk to us about this. It's been a really mind and consciousness expanding conversation for me. And guess what? If people want to read work by a disabled person, they can check out your book, Against Technoableism. How's that for a plug?
Oh, I love it. Thank you.
And you can pick it up at our special bookshop, factuallypod.com/books. But where else can people find the book and find your work, Ashley?
I have a website called techanddisability.com, which will have some open access educational materials that'll come out in January that we're pretty excited about. That's basically a whole bunch of readings from disabled people. And that's pretty fun. But also, if you pick up the book or a reading guide about it, I want you to read other people's books, right? So there are lots of things I reference, but then you can also follow up with lots of different memoir, poetry. I've mentioned Bill Peace's blog. It's fantastic. There's no dearth of this. There's a lot for people to check out, and that makes me really happy.
That's so wonderful. Ashley, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you once again to Ashley Hsu for that incredible interview. If you want to pick up a copy of her book, you can get it at factuallypod.com/books, where your purchase supports not just this show, but your local bookstore as well. If you want to support this show directly, head to patreon.com/AdamConover. $5 a month gets you every episode of the show ad-free. We even have a community Discord, a lot of other great perks. $15 a month, I will read your name at the end of this podcast, and it'll go in the credits of every one of my video monologues. This week, I want to thank Busy Bee, Lois Bell, DPEJ, Ahmet A., and Monica Thompson. Thank you so much for your support. You make this show possible. I also want to thank my producers, Sam Roudman and Tony Wilson, everybody here at HeadGum who makes this show happen. You can find me online at Adam Conover, wherever you get your social media. Head to adamconover.net for my tickets and tour dates. Please come see me on the road in New York, Boston, Atlanta. Oh my God, I'm headed to San Francisco soon. Please come out and see me. Would love to see you there. And until then, we'll see you next time on Factually.
That was a HeadGum podcast.